right. Once again, thank you very much, everybody. We are very appreciative that so many people are joining tonight's call. And we have to ask you to press star 6 to put yourself on mute until we get to question and answer period. Once again, my name is Jackie Cabasso. I'm the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation in Oakland and national co-convener of UFPJ with Terry Rockefeller of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. I'm also the convener of UFPJ's Nuclear Disarmament Redefining Security Working Group, working on the subject of tonight's call. Tonight's national conference call will address the Iran nuclear deal, which is called also the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, negotiated by the U.S., Russia, the U.K., China,
Ronnie
France,
Lowell.
Germany, and Iran to ensure that Iran's nuclear program remains peaceful, and the serious challenges we're facing in getting it through Congress. Our presenters are Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, Tyler Cullis with the National Iranian American Council, and Lara Friedman of Americans for Peace Now. The call is scheduled to last for 1 hour, and it is being recorded. We will provide a callback number so that you can listen to the call, and we'll post it on our UFPJ website.
Okay, I'm in.
I want to introduce Carolyn Eisenberg, who many of you know as Rusty. We'll be introducing our speakers. Rusty is a professor of U.S. foreign policy at Hofstra University, and she's with Brooklyn for Peace, and is the co-convener of UFPJ's Legislative Action Working Group with Gail Murphy. UFPJ is currently operating a network of local and national organizations facilitated by a volunteer coordinating committee. Fortunately, we have been able to hire Matt DeVlieger on a part-time basis,
which
has greatly increased our capacity, but we depend on donations from member groups and individuals to make our work possible. If you appreciate briefing calls on critical issues like this one, please make a donation if you can. You can donate on our website, unitedforpeace.org. So let me turn it over to Rusty now to introduce our speakers. And again, if you have not already done so, please mute yourself by pressing star 6. Rusty?
Okay, I'm on. Good. All right, everybody muted. I'm going to try to be real quick in introducing our speakers, and what I'm going to do is just tell you all who they are very briefly, and then let them each speak sequentially. And our plan is for each of them to speak for 10 minutes and then to open up the floor for questions, comments, et cetera. I do just want to notice that there seem to be about a zillion people on this call, which I think is just phenomenal in terms of what it's saying about how strongly people are feeling about this issue. So our speakers tonight are, first of all, Phyllis Bennis, who probably needs no introduction because she's been a stalwart of UFPJ since the beginning. She directs the New Internationalist Project at IPS. She is a writer, an analyst, an activist. She's on television all the time. She's written countless books. She has a brand new book out on the war on ISIS, which I would encourage everybody to get. And Phyllis has just been with this struggle for years and years and years, and it's a pleasure to have her on the call. We also have Tyler Cullis, who is not a stranger to UFPJ either. He initially worked on our staff for many years, subsequently went to law school. He's now a policy associate at the National Iranian American Council, and he provides legislative and advocacy outreach on all of these issues. And Tyler has been doing a tremendous job of making material available to activists around the country. So it's actually great to have Tyler come back and join us. And finally, we have a person we have not worked with before, Lara Friedman from Americans for Peace Now. Some of you may already know this. Lara does these legislative alerts for them, which are just phenomenal, a tremendous resource. So we wanted her on the call tonight because of the very particular work that she has been doing around the lobbying and the whole struggle in Congress. And she is the director of policy and government relations for Americans for Peace Now. And she's a person who was at one time in the Foreign Service. She's a journalist. She briefs members of Congress and administration officials on issues concerning Israel and the Middle East. And we're really very grateful that she is joining us. So we have three really wonderful people. I know this is always a challenging technology, but I would like to, my suggestion is, if this is okay, literally, Phyllis, if you would start us off for about 10 minutes, Tyler for 10 minutes, and then we'll turn to Laura, and then try to open it up to everybody. Does that seem like it's going to work? Well, nobody can say anything because you're all muted. All right, Phyllis, you want to start us off? And
okay.
Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks, Rusty. Thanks, all of you, for being on the call. Let me just ask, while we're talking, as you all know, the pinging really is distracting. So, Jackie and Rusty, if either of you can do anything to turn off that pinging, it would be enormously helpful. So what I'm going to try and do really quickly in 10 minutes is go through a bit about why this agreement is so important, what its potential gains might be, a bit on its opponents, some on the impact on the region, a little on the impact on Israel, although I'm going to leave most of that for Laura, and then a few talking points for convincing others, and close with a couple of points that are important to the peace movement but probably are things that are less important immediately in terms of lobbying but important for us to know. And hopefully I can do all of that really fast in the next 10 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions. So if I skip things too quickly, you can come back in questions. So, on the immediate question, Obama is making a lot of the right arguments. He's not making all the arguments, but a lot of the arguments he's making are right. It's a rare moment on issues of war and peace that the president is actually saying a lot of the right things. In the immediate, this is a huge victory of diplomacy over war. Ironically, supporters of sanctions, which some people on this call may have supported, many of us opposed for a host of reasons I won't get into, but supporters of sanctions probably should be cheering, because the goal of sanctions was precisely to bring Iran to the table. And while Iran came to the table for a host of other reasons, not just because of sanctions, sanctions supporters certainly can be claiming it. The problem is a lot of supporters of sanctions are saying, we want more, this isn't good enough. In the longer term, this agreement is a really important example of how diplomacy works, and that diplomacy works. And that's a very important thing, to have that kind of an example to point to in an era where there's such a discourse that says war is better than diplomacy. It's important to keep the focus on what is the alternative to this agreement. It's not a, quote, better agreement. There ain't going to be no better agreement. There ain't going to be no more negotiations on this one. Everybody went home. There's nobody left at the table. Nobody is left in Vienna. The negotiations are over. The alternative is this agreement or no agreement. And no agreement means the threat of war. So it's that stark. The alternative, of course, would be to undermine in the longer term not only the threat of war right now, but undermine the potential for future diplomacy, because the role of the U.S., the legitimacy of the U.S. as a diplomatic actor, will be completely undermined. If it's seen as Congress being able to undermine an agreement by the president, nobody's going to be willing to negotiate with the president in a serious way if they think that it can just be undermined by the whim of a few members of Congress. So what's the potential for this agreement? One, it actually does prevent a very likely possibility of a new illegal war in the region, a new illegal war in the Middle East. It prevents the potential future possible creation, something that does not exist now, but the potential future creation of a second nuclear weapons arsenal in this very volatile region, the first being the one existing nuclear weapons arsenal, that being Israel's. It does not end or acknowledge or call for inspections of Israel's nuclear arsenal, but it does prevent the possibility, potential future creation of a second nuclear weapons arsenal. It does that by stopping the production of plutonium. It transforms the only reactor that could produce plutonium into a reactor that cannot produce plutonium. It stops the production of highly enriched uranium, cutting the stockpile massively of both low and medium enriched uranium, and cutting the number of centrifuges that can enrich uranium at all down to just over 5,000 from a current high of 19,000. So it prevents Iran's capacity, if it ever chose, something that it has not chosen to do, as defined by all 16 U.S. military agencies that say Iran has not decided that it even wants a nuclear weapon, but it prevents them from being able to do it. It does call for 24/7 inspections of nuclear sites, of all nuclear sites, that covers the entire uranium production process. Just one note, when you hear all this stuff about how it doesn't call for 24/7 nuclear inspections, that's a lie. It does. What it doesn't call for, and what no agreement has in history has ever called for, is 24/7 inspections of non-nuclear weapon sites, meaning any old thing that the U.S. or any other country decides they want inspectors to look at. They can, the inspectors can, but if Iran wants to challenge that, they can challenge it in a process that could be up to 24 days. They'll have to accede to the inspection. But that's only for non-nuclear sites, things that are suspected by somebody but have no basis, no connection to nuclear power production. The last thing in terms of potential is that it lays the potential for a much better shot at creating something that Jackie and so many others of us have worked on for so long, the creation of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. That's something that the U.S. is, in fact, on record supporting, although no one in the State Department or the White House will ever acknowledge it. Article 14 of U.N. Security Council resolution that ended the first Gulf War in 1991, Article 14 calls for the goal of establishing in the Middle East a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction and the missiles to deliver them. Period, full stop, no exceptions. Israel's nuclear arsenal is in direct violation of that article. That is something to point to members of Congress who say, you know, we've never supported a nuclear weapons-free zone. Well, we've gone beyond that to say a weapons of mass destruction-free zone, which is even broader. Now, a note on the opponents, they have no alternative proposal beyond saying, well, we should just go back and negotiate harder and impose more sanctions. But as I said earlier, negotiations are over. That boat has sailed. It's done. The agreement is very narrow. It covers only nuclear issues and nuclear-based sanctions. It doesn't include all the considerations about Iran's role in the region, so-called terrorism, or anything else. It's the only kind of agreement that might have been able to win support from all sides. So opponents who say it's too narrow, it doesn't include the region, terrorism, blah, 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 that's not the basis for opposition. It was never designed to do anything other than prevent an Iranian nuclear weapons capacity and end the sanctions. The impact on the region, there's the potential for a so-called grand bargain between the U.S. and Iran that, if it happened, could really begin the process of changing all the political alliances in the region, including the primacy of the U.S. alliance with Sunni governments, particularly Saudi Arabia and the other Gulfies. It could lead to an end to the kind of precipice of war position between Iran and Saudi Arabia in their regional competition. That's the reason that the Saudi king welcomed the agreement, however grudgingly. It sets up the potential for collaboration on a real diplomatic end to the Syria and Iraq wars right now. If Iran was at the table, something the U.S. has prohibited up until now, the possibility of real negotiations is much greater. If the Western isolation of Iran, the most powerful and ironically the most stable country in the region at the moment, could be normalized, a lot of things become possible for the future. Very quickly, the impact on Israel, again, I'm going to leave a lot of this to Lara, but I think it's important that to recognize something that Kerry said the other day. If Israel is seen as the spoiler, it will face even more danger. It will be even more isolated. Despite the rhetoric of Bibi Netanyahu, former Mossad people, other intelligence people, and even some former political leaders are saying that the agreement would make Israel safer. Current political leaders in Israel are unified against the agreement. So the opposition, the so-called opposition leader in the Israeli Knesset, is behind Netanyahu all the way in opposing the agreement. AIPAC, I think Lara will speak to this, did lobby for war in Iraq, but it's important to recognize that their focus was always stronger on urging war against Iran, because that's been the Israeli position. They supported the war against Iraq. First priority was war against Iran. There's a congressional delegation in Israel right now being pressured to oppose the resolution. Other Israeli officials, the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, and others have made very strong statements opposing Netanyahu. Dozens of U.S. generals now are supporting it. The Israeli president, if not supporting the deal directly, opposes Netanyahu's opposition. The former chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, said that Washington needs to reexamine all its relationships in the Middle East, especially with Sunni-dominated countries, and said that the rapprochement with Iran could be a better balance for U.S. diplomacy. Senator Feinstein said that rapprochement with Iran could help reverse the declining U.S. influence in the Middle East. Finally, a couple of points that are important to us as the peace movement that may or may not be useful in terms of lobbying and convincing doubters, that sort of thing. One is that this is the best way for Iran to be able to end the sanctions, which are destroying the economic life of normal people across the country. It will significantly strengthen supporters of a more open political system in Iran. It will weaken the hardline militarists, just like here in the U.S. This was a very important remark in President Obama's speech when he compared the Republican opposition. He should have included Democratic opposition like Schumer. It's not just Republicans, we should be clear. But the U.S. opponents are, as he put it, just like the hardliners in Iran. And then finally, I just want to flag one potential danger, which is to the Palestinians. The Palestinians may pay an enormous price for this deal because the U.S. is determined to give Israel a kind of compensation, a prize, you know, a consolation prize, if you will. And that prize, we're already seeing it in terms of a vast increase. This was already being discussed, but there's no question that the Iran deal escalated those negotiations. It's going to go from a $30 billion military aid package over 10 years. The next 10 years is going to be $47 billion, an enormous, more than 50% increase. There also is likely going to be unacknowledged but very clear agreements by the U.S. not to challenge Israel in its next foray against Gaza. I don't know what else, what other form it will take, but I think that there's a very significant danger that Palestine and Palestinians will pay a price for this deal. Let me stop. I've gone too far, and we'll take the rest of the questions.
Okay. Kyla, can you talk that fast?
I lived in New York for 10 years.
Okay, so I've been asked to talk about what's happening in Congress. So I'm going to do a brief outline of where we are in Congress, how we got there, and where I think we're going. And there's going to be dates, so if people have pen and paper, it might be useful to jot some of these down. In May, Congress passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. This established a congressional review period and outlined a series of steps that Congress could take in relation to the deal. It could, one, approve the deal via a joint resolution of approval, two, reject the deal via a joint resolution of disapproval, or it could take no action at all. Congress took this step because the nuclear deal was not envisioned to be and is not a treaty per se, so Congress was not going to get a say in the matter otherwise. But instead of getting an affirmative say, i.e. the deal could not take effect without the approval of Congress, what the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act requires is for Congress to express itself negatively in order to have any effect on the deal. So what process is established under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act? So under the Act, the President is obligated to transmit the text of the deal and all supporting documentation to Congress within 5 days of reaching an agreement. That agreement was reached on July 14th. Materials were submitted on July 19th. And what is a 60-calendar-day clock started on July 20th. This 60-calendar-day clock is the period in which Congress could hold hearings, as it has done, and otherwise review the nuclear deal. During these 60 calendar days, as well as within the prior period, what Congress did is prohibited the president from relieving any statutory sanctions, meaning sanctions passed by Congress, other than those sanctions that had been relieved under the interim deal agreed to back.
I think we just lost.
What matters for our purposes is the joint resolution of disapproval, as that would seriously compromise the United States' ability to be a party and to live up to its end of this deal. If Congress passes a joint resolution of disapproval, which would likely take 60 votes in the Senate in order to invoke cloture to end debate, then the resolution will be able to go to the president as with any other legislation for the president's signature. Tack on an additional period of 12 calendar days above and beyond the 60 calendar days from the time Congress passes a resolution of disapproval, during which the president also would not be able to relieve sanctions on Iran. The president has obviously said that he will veto that resolution, and that resolution would then return to Congress for an override vote. Upon the president's veto, there will be an additional 10 calendar days above and beyond the 60, and then the 12 will be tacked on, and under which the president could not release sanctions. My belief is that Obama would veto on the first day that he was presented a resolution of disapproval, so the 10-day period would run simultaneous with the 12-day period. As any other bill, both houses of Congress would need two-thirds of their members to override the president's veto. If there is an override, the president would be prevented from relieving statutory sanctions, and the U.S. would not be able to comply with the deal. If one or more houses cannot muster two-thirds of its members to override the president's veto, then the president can undertake sanctions relief as is currently provided in law, and the U.S. would be able to live up to its obligations. So where are we now? We're at, I believe today is day 24 of the 60 calendar day congressional review period. It's August recess, so members are back in their home districts. The House and Senate return back into session at sometime, I believe, between September 8th and the 11th. So Congress has to send a joint resolution of disapproval to the president no later than midnight, September 17th. At which point the 60-day review period ends. If the Congress passes a joint resolution of disapproval at a date later than that, it can do so, but the implications under this act would not attach, so the president would still be able to release sanctions unless the Congress stated otherwise. From what I've heard, the Senate might vote as early as September 9th on a resolution of disapproval, though this is all in somewhat of a state of flux. That would leave 20-something odd days from today before a vote is made on the resolution of disapproval. It's certainly not outside the realm of possibility that the Senate would be unable to get the 60 votes necessary to invoke cloture, which would effectively stop this whole process in its tracks. But to be honest, I think that'll be an uphill climb. And the House would likely vote in the days before the September 17th deadline on the resolution of disapproval. Right now, 17 senators have come out in public support for the deal, so we're halfway there to the 34 needed to block override vote. Perhaps a dozen other senators are leaning towards support of the deal, and there's a host of undecideds. On the House side, I think the goal is to rally what were 150 members who signed on to a letter back in May expressing support for the president's negotiations with Iran. That letter was premised on the idea that we needed at least one-third of the House to block a veto override vote. We got the numbers in that letter. We got 150. So now the goal is to build confidence in those members who signed on that they have the support to continue to act as a bulwark against deal opponents. I think that's the lay of the land in Congress. I totally agree with Phyllis. You can't discount how big of a deal this is. The president's framing of this issue as one between this deal or a war is certainly hyperbolic to some extent, but perhaps less than we think. The alternatives to this deal, if Congress rejects it, are not good, not good at all. And as USPJ knows so well, once you get into a war, it is really difficult to get out. So I think this is a unique opportunity for us to avoid conflict before.
This is a rubber thing, Scott. Please. God.
Whoever's on the phone, please mute.
Yeah, this is, excuse me, just one second. This is Jackie. I tried to figure out how to mute everybody at once. The problem with doing that is that the speakers get muted. So we have to be very disciplined and ask everybody, again, I hear heavy breathing. Please, everybody except the speaker, mute yourself by pressing star six. Thank you.
Tyler, thank you. Could we go quickly to... I mean, this is incredibly informative, I think, for everybody. Laura, can we turn to you and hopefully have some time for questions and clarity?
Sure. So I'm going to go really fast. I think Phyllis and Tyler did an extraordinary job sort of giving the lay of the land, both on the policy issues and in Congress. I think I want to zoom out a little bit. And first, I want to say, for all the folks who are madly trying to write down what Tyler was saying, an enormous amount of energy has been put into making all of this very easily available to activists. So I would encourage everyone who has an internet connection to get online, go to your favorite progressive organization, my organization, Americans for Peace Now. We have probably the best resources on this that we've ever compiled on any issue outside of settlements. NIAC has amazing resources. Win Without War, FCNL, really, pick your progressive group. What we are doing all of this for, the reason that we are putting out these very clear, simple timelines and you know, taking all of those really complex talking points that Phyllis laid out so well and giving you neat, tidy sound bites and more or less, you know, giving you messaging that you can take directly to your members of Congress is because you don't need to be a nuclear scientist to take this on as an activist. Do not feel intimidated by the details of this. The other side doesn't actually care that much about the facts, and that's always, I think, a problem for progressives. It's sort of like watching Al Gore debate George Bush. You know, Al Gore insisted on facts and wasn't nearly as pithy a debater as Al Gore, or George Bush, who just threw things out. In this battle for the hearts and minds of Americans on the Iran deal, your activist leaders around the country are doing a great job getting you the information you need. So, you know, for everyone who's looking at it and saying, wow, AIPAC is dominating. It's not just AIPAC. It's the Israel Project. It's CUPE, Christians United for Israel. The evangelicals are out in front on this. You don't have to go to their websites to see it. If you're on Twitter, if you're on any email list, they are bombarding activists. They are bombarding members of Congress with very simplistic messaging, most of which does not bear any scrutiny. When you start scrutinizing it, it doesn't hold up to the facts. The real mission right now, for whether you're doing this because you're anti-war or my organization, we're doing it because we believe it's the right thing for Middle East peace and stability, and you know, whatever it is, whatever it is that makes you want to make sure this deal doesn't fall apart. And I agree very much with what both Tyler and Phyllis said. The stakes here really couldn't be higher. There is no alternative. This is the moment, very much like before the Iraq War, which many people on this call, all the people on this call remember. If there was any time to become active and engage your members of Congress, write letters to the editor, or for goodness sake, go to the town meetings. Your members of Congress are holding events right now during this period. If they don't hear from the pro-peace, pro-diplomacy community, they will believe that the only voices in their community really want them to vote no on the deal. And as Tyler said, just looking at the Senate, we have 17 members who are solidly in favor. We have another dozen or so we think are leaning. Those dozen or so need to hear from you. And the ones that are undecided, undeclared, need to hear from you. House members as well. So I'm going to just encourage you. There's a website that was set up called 60daystostopawar.com, which has this really neat thing where you enter your zip code, and it'll tell you all the events near you that you can go to in person and make your voice heard, voting with your feet. This is a moment for real grassroots activism, making yourself heard. As I said to my organization's activists, this is the time to mobilize your friends, your families, your social networks. We have, I don't want to sound, you know, like this is, you know, this is something we should win. And Tyler, you know, NIAC and Peace Now and other groups have worked together. We have defeated the forces that wanted to kill diplomacy over and over on the road to where we are today. We have stopped them in their tracks as they push legislation in Congress, backed by AIPAC, lobbied by the Israeli government strongly. We stopped legislation over and over that it would have undermined and potentially killed the diplomatic process before it had a chance to bear fruit. they understand the other side, that the stakes are higher. They understand that they have to win. We understand that we cannot lose on this, and we shouldn't lose. So I guess, I mean, I'm more than happy to talk about, I mean, there's no mystery here to what the opponents of the deal are saying. They're out front. The talking points are thin. They're easily refuted. You don't have to be a nuclear scientist to refute them. Use the resources available. And I would encourage you, all the different websites have done this, like my organization's website, in response to questions from activists, I've set up a page that has nothing but quotes from Israeli validators. Because you know what? No matter how much I try to convince a member of Congress of the arguments, it's always stronger for me to say, no, don't listen to me. Look what the former head of Israeli military intelligence said. We have pages where we have compiled, all different organizations have done this. You know, we've compiled the statements by 100 former ambassadors, including 5 former ambassadors to Israel who served under both Republican and Democratic presidents. We have the letter from the scientists now. I mean, we have the letter from the military leaders. We should feel empowered and strong and insisting that our voices were heard. And for me, the reason I agreed to speak on this call tonight, really, between Phyllis and Tyler, you know everything you need to know from them about the deal itself and about the state of play. I am here to light a fire under people's butts. That's all there is to it. This is the moment to get active. We can win this. I think we will win it, but we cannot for a moment rest until this is over. I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you, Lara. That's really, really helpful, and just reminds all of us about how high the stakes really are, you know, in this particular effort. I think, Jackie, do you want to take stack? And then just as we get to the end, I want to come back to, you know, what are the things people could do. But I do want to emphasize again, UFPJ is putting resources on its website, as well as the other organizations that were mentioned. And if you didn't write it all down, most of you have our email. You can get right in touch with us. Also, this website now, How to Stop War with Iran, which MoveOn is doing, very, very valuable because it enables you to find out where there are town hall meetings going on in your congressional district, which can be very difficult to do. So these are all really helpful things. So, Jackie, do you want to take stack?
Okay, thank you, Rusty. So we have over 100 people on this call, and so we're going to have to be very disciplined. We have about 20 minutes for questions, comments, suggestions, and I would invite you to unmute yourself by pressing the star and the 6, and then saying stack, and give me your name, and I'll call on you one at a time so that people don't talk over each other.
Stack, Aliza.
Aliva? Okay. Anyone else?
Stack.
Yes.
Tell me your name, please.
Rosemary Pace.
Norman Rupp.
Rosemary Norman. Okay.
Stack.
Okay, your
Mariana.
Name, please.
Mariana.
Mariana. Okay.
Floriana.
Okay. Someone else?
David
right,
Young.
David? Okay. All right, let's start with these. And so please give your name and your location and organization if you are with one. Aliva? Aliva? Okay. I don't know what that will come back to her. Rosemary?
Yeah, this is Rosemary Pace from Pax Christi Metro, New York. And I've been a staunch supporter of this Iran deal, but I'm very concerned about what was just said about how Israel is going to benefit, in a sense, if the deal actually goes through, and Palestine is going to suffer. So I'm wondering what suggestions there are to deal with that, to address that problem.
Okay, why don't we take the stack, and then the speakers can respond to several questions or comments. Norman? Are
yes,
you there, Norman?
Norman Robbins
yes.
From... Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Norman Robbins from Cleveland Peace Action. I'd like to know from those of the speakers that have actually talked to people in Congress, since the deal was... What are the most impactful meaningful statements that the peace people can make, and what that they've found by experience work best of all the points that could be made.
Also, this is Aliza back on stack.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Thank you, Norman. Go ahead, Aliza. And please mute yourself again once you've spoken. Star 6. Go ahead, Aliza.
Oh, my question is especially about, for the second speaker, about Congress. Which are the Republican senators who are most likely to endorse early, just as Schumer opposed early?
Okay, thank you. Mariana?
Gloriana.
Gloriana.
Pasadena. my question has to do with a past class that I took on nuclear age. And one of the things I'm hearing is that it's suddenly all become about Israel instead of world peace. So I did learn in that class that there is a film that the military has that they supposedly are not allowing anyone to see about what happened in Hiroshima. And I would like to ask the president at this moment to say, please show that film.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's what the public and the world needs to see.
Okay,
what actually happens.
okay, thank you. David?
Yes. I live in Killingworth, and I work with the Greater New Haven Peace Council. They did, along with some other activists, have a meeting with Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. He is one of the undecideds, I believe, and I was not at that meeting, but I don't think he made a commitment. He listened to the concerns of the group. He claimed that, you know, he was not going to let anyone influence him, which I guess would include, I asked about, you know, Senator Schumer's opposition to the agreement. But he claimed that he was undecided and, you know, he was still working that out. So I think that's where Senator Blumenthal is. I was just wondering whether it would be useful to maybe send, like, an open letter to Senator Ben Cardin, the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee, who's obviously he's a key senator here. And he said that, of course, he is one of the undecideds, and he said that he was not, according to what I read in the Huffington Post, he said that he was not going to make a decision until after Labor Day or something. But I was just wondering whether, like, sending an open letter to Senator Cardin would be a worthwhile idea.
Okay, thank you, David. So let's turn it back to our speakers, and just for efficiency, maybe we could just ask each of you to speak in turn to answer whichever of those questions you wanted to. The first question, Phyllis, had to do with Palestine.
Right. There were two questions that I thought I would take on, Rosemary's and Norman's. Rosemary's question on the problem that Israel will benefit, it is a reality. It's something we have to face. It doesn't change the fact that this agreement is enormously important for the region and for the world. We have to keep in mind the potential price that could be paid by the Palestinians, and what it means is we have to be prepared to mobilize just as hard to defend Palestinian rights if they are indeed threatened, as I'm afraid they could be, as we are fighting for this agreement to be implemented. That means that if Israel attacks Gaza again, or if it attacks Lebanon, going after supposedly Hezbollah, we need to be prepared to mobilize on an all-hands-on-deck basis, the same as we're doing to protect this agreement. It does not mean that we should withhold our support for this agreement because it could threaten Palestine. For one thing, Palestine is under enormous threat already. That hasn't changed. Norman's question about the most impactful statement, Tyler is probably more of an expert, and Laura certainly more of an expert than I, but I just think the most important thing to remember with all of our members of Congress is you, in your district, you know them, you know their staff, you know, are they usually very sympathetic to AIPAC's line? If so, all of those resources that Laura just talked about Israeli validators, that's what you use. If there's somebody who generally is worried about costs, then you use that argument. The arguments are all out there. It's important that you do a little bit of research ahead of time before you get your meeting with your member, before you get the meeting with their staff. As Laura said, you don't have to be an expert on this stuff. You don't have to be an expert on the details of the agreement or on nuclear weapons. You need to know the principles that you stand for, but you do also need to know what's important to your member of Congress. Who are the lobbyists that give them the most money? And be sure you answer the allegations that you think those lobbyists are bringing about. I just wanted to mention one other thing, which actually wasn't an answer to anybody's question. I'm going to say it anyway. Just one other resource. Kevin Martin, the executive director of Peace Action, and I just did an op-ed last week that went out to about 300 small papers across the country on the need for people who support diplomacy to stand up. Anybody can use that, the text of it. It's on the IPS website. Amend it, you know, change two sentences and put it out in your own name if you like, whatever. We're not trying to hold on to the language. Use it. It's written at a very basic level. That's the kind of thing that small papers are willing to run. So just one additional resource.
Okay, thanks, Phyllis. Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, to tack on what is, I think, the most useful messaging for members is, I mean, you know, on the one hand, President Obama has certainly believed that and certainly led with the messaging that it is either this deal or war, and he has certainly pressed opponents of the deal to present an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And we're over 3 weeks into this debate, and no alternative has been presented yet. And I think that speaks volumes. Now, you're going to get members pressing you on saying, well, the fact that there's no alternative isn't good. And at that point, you bring in what Laura described earlier, which is the number of validators, both in the United States, in Israel, elsewhere around the world, who have signed on to letters, put themselves out there in support of the deal. I mean, we even have an example of the president of one of the leading anti-deal groups, the United Against Nuclear Iran, Gary Seymour, who just resigned his post because he supports the deal. Meeting with examples like that, I think, is a really powerful message to members. On the question of whether there would be any early endorsees in the Republican Senate, the answer is likely no. We had two options. One was Rand Paul, who I think was the first out of the gate in opposition to the deal. He was on MSNBC stating his opposition to the deal on the day of the deal, running for president, so he has other obligations right now. And the other one is Jeff Flake. And Flake will be traveling with Kerry to Cuba. He had traveled to Cuba earlier to bring Alan Gross home. He was in favor of the president's opening to Cuba. He traveled with the president to Africa when Obama went to Kenya. So the administration is making a big push for Jeff Flake. It's really hard for Jeff Flake, being the sole member of the Republican caucus, to stand out and support the deal. But nonetheless, there's a lot of pressure on him there. Other than that, I don't think you're going to see anybody on the Republican side of the aisle come out and support the deal, which makes putting the pressure on the Democrats so important.
Okay, thanks, Tyler. Laura, did you want to add anything?
Sure. First, on the first question, the question of Israel benefiting, I want to say something and you know, be very, very clear. Israel has reasonable concerns with this Iran deal. They live in the neighborhood. There's tremendous hostility still being articulated from Iran. I want to make clear, when people are lobbying this, when they're talking to the members of Congress, I would hope, I say this as an activist who, you know, is working, you know, every day for Israeli-Palestinian, Israeli-Arab peace, I would hope people could keep in mind as they make these arguments, you know, assistance to Israel that is about making sure that Israel feels reassured and safe in this deal, not saying, yes, you can attack Gaza, do whatever you want, but it's a position which says, we support this deal, and as part of that, we support, you know, the argument I've been making all along, as I get more frustrated with, you know, this adamant Israeli opposition to the deal, and I say to my Israeli friends and colleagues, at what point, instead of just saying zero-sum opposition, are you going to start talking about the real equities Israel has at stake in terms of regional security, and what you think is, you know, going to be needed to reassure Israel in a security formula that's changed? So I just would ask people to bear that in mind. In terms of the question of, you know, what do we all do who care about Israeli-Palestinian peace, I would say we have to be able to walk and chew gum. I think as much as people are afraid that this deal could potentially have bad implications for the Palestinians, I would guarantee to you that people who are on the right side of the political spectrum are just as worried that it's going to have bad implications for Israel on the peace process. There are people, I hear this every day, you know, Obama, first it's Cuba, then Iran, and then he's going to go get tough on the Israelis on Israel-Palestine. You know, I joked, you know, on the record, the same reason that people like me never give up on Obama is the same, or never completely give up on Obama and Israel-Palestine, is the same reason the right never trusts him. We all believe he has it in him to do something consequential and constructive. They're afraid he will. I still hope that he will. So I think the jury is still out on how this is going to work. Supporting this deal has to be separated from that. On the last question, David, you know, question of, you know, someone like Senator Blumenthal, who my understanding is he's, everything I've read, everything I've heard, he's studying, he's very much on the fence, he feels he's under a lot of pressure. People like Blumenthal need to hear from constituents over and over. And this goes back to Norman's question about what the most impactful messages are. The most impactful message always is, ma'am, sir, I am a constituent, I am a voter, and I want you to support this deal. Everything else is narrative. It's commentary. The most important thing is that the voters are saying, sir, ma'am, I want you to support this deal. An open letter to Cardin, sure. At this point, it is vital that voices are heard. You know, Phyllis said there's an op-ed out there that you can use. Fantastic. I would tell you that my board members that for Peace for Americans for Peace Now, I'm seeing, you know, more and more board members wanting to write op-eds. It's very exciting. We've had several op-eds in the Jewish press. We had one in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I mean, these are things that members of Congress, House and Senate, pay attention to. I have constituents who care about this enough to go on the record in public and speak out. Fantastic. And that's what we all need to keep doing.
Thank you, Laura. And this is Jackie. I just wanted to add two things. One is kind of in response to Gloriana's point. As somebody who has worked for nuclear abolition globally for more than 30 years, it really galls me to, this deal galls me in a way, because Iran is being singled out for just unprecedented monitoring inspection. On the other hand, what I'm saying is that the standards that are being imposed on Iran should become the new universal standards imposed on every country, and that the P5, who are the ones that negotiate with Iran, are the nuclear-armed states under the NPT, and they have not disarmed as they promised to 45 years ago. Second thing is on letters to the editor, just a tip if you don't know this already. If you include your congressperson's name in the op-ed, they will read it. So that's just an easy way to generate public pressure. Okay,
Jackie, sorry, could I just add two quick points before we go to the next round?
Mm-hmm.
One, just on the importance of also supporting the Democrats who have taken the right position already.
I
agree that the main...
Right.
Folks, mute yourselves, please. It's really distracting. Star six. One, it's for people who are already taking the right position, they need to hear from their constituents that we've got your back. We're not going to abandon you to the bad guys who are going to be pressuring you and who are going to be all over you and trying to defeat you. So even though we should be concentrating on those that are waffling and wiggling and whatever, don't forget the good guys. And send your thanks over and over again. Send them flowers, send them cupcakes, whatever it takes. The second thing, I just wanted to add one point to Laura's point. There's obviously some differences between Laura's position and mine and perhaps others here, but I think the key thing of in terms of how we deal with the question, for example, of aid to Israel, it doesn't mean that you have to support either the current $30 billion over 10 years or the future $47 billion in military aid to come out in support of this deal. It does mean, I think, that we don't have to make that the talking point for mobilizing in this next 24 days that we have left. After that 24 days, we go right back to opposing all military aid to Israel, or many of us do. And whatever they feel about how much it's needed or whatever is not the point. That opposition is a long-standing campaign in the U.S. Many of us are part of it, and we will continue to be. But we can, as Lara said, walk and chew gum at the same time. We can also walk here and chew gum there, not feel that we have to do them all at the same time.
Got it.
Okay, thanks, Phyllis. We are almost at the hour, but we started a little bit late. So if there are other people who want to say something, let's take one more sec.
Stack.
Yeah, Lisa.
Stack. Jeff Stack.
Jeff?
Art Stack.
Art, okay. I heard somebody.
Can everybody be heard if you silenced yourself?
You have to press star 6 to unmute yourself.
To unsilence?
Yes, same thing, star 6. You can do it as many times as you want. Could whoever has that siren in the background mute themselves? Okay, I have Jeff and Art. Were there others?
Henry Stack.
Okay, Henry.
Aliza Stack.
Aliza, who already spoke?
Well, I had a question, but I have a suggestion now.
Okay.
I think we should take people who haven't had a chance.
Yeah, let's see if there's anybody else.
Michael Stack.
Michael.
All the same name?
Jeff Lane.
Anyone else?
I think
Joe Calhoun.
I'm sorry? The man?
Joe Calhoun, Colorado.
No. Okay, and I heard one more woman. Did I hear Kathleen?
Yes.
Okay.
Jackie,
so
I think we have to be a little mindful of the time.
Yes. No, I understand that. So, Aliza, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to pass. We'll have to continue with email. So if people can be very, very brief, we'll use the same procedure and ask the speakers to respond at the end. So, Jeff?
Okay, thanks to all. I'm from Missouri, and we'll have to work out our strategy with the Congress folks here. But I had a question about some of the folks with national aspirations. I mean, Senator Schumer, of course, came out in strong opposition to this, but wanting to be, you know, the leader of the Senate next time around here, is there a national strategy to push on him? And then also Alan Grayson, for one, I was greatly disappointed to hear that he's a strong opponent of this measure as well. Progressive wants to run for the Florida Senate, so I told him, called his office to say I wasn't going to contribute to his campaign. But I just wonder about other strategies like that for some so-called progressives or people with higher aspirations.
Thank you, Jeff. Put yourself back on mute, please. Star 6. Art?
This is a parallel to the concern about the Palestinians and it's about the Yemenis. I understand there's now a ground war. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia has invaded on the ground, and the U.S. is giving logistical support. NPR says that unlike the U.S. and British careful bombing, that the Saudis are totally attacking civilian personnel with U.S. logistical support because the U.S. needs to give a favor to Saudi Arabia over this deal. Any comments?
Henry?
I have a suggestion. I don't know how useful it would be. I'm also in New Haven, Connecticut, and the peace movement in Connecticut has been unable to meet with Blumenthal for over 4 years. He's running for re-election next year. I happen to be on the Democratic Town Committee in New Haven, and I submitted a resolution calling on Blumenthal to support his president in a peace agreement. He called me on the phone and asked for a meeting. So that was in June. We had a meeting in June, and in that meeting, he agreed to meet again. So David had mentioned that we met with him on Monday. I think that if there are any, if anybody knows people who are in Democratic Party organizations, that there are ways of
making the members of Congress feel pressure that go beyond I'm a constituent, because we are the ones who get out the vote. That's it.
Thank you, Henry. Michael?
This is Michael Eisenshire, National Coordinator of U.S. Labor Against the War. We are circulating a statement for labor leaders to sign on in support of the agreement. And to make things simple, if you're interested, you are a labor leader, you know a labor leader, write to me at info@uslaboragainstwar.org. uslaboragainstwar.org. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Joe?
Yeah, I've been more focused on stopping the war against Syria, but one of the things I'd like to suggest is 2013 and 2014. One of the techniques I use, because you can call your congressman, you can call your senator, and you can write them letters, and they'll listen to the constituents. If you try to call another senator or another congressman, they will tell you to defer you to your constituents. But one effective way I found of getting something into their office was, and this is at the UN too, UN missions, is to get their fax numbers. And the article that Phyllis wrote can be easily faxed to. They always have these charts or these of who's voting for, who's leaning against, who's leaning for, who's committed. And if you get the names of those congressmen and senators who are leaning this way or that way, you can very effectively get right into their office with a fax. And it's been a very effective tool for me. I've seen some of my stuff actually on the Senate floor.
Okay, thanks, Joe. And Kathleen.
Kathleen Cray from Aspen, Colorado. I read that Schumer said if Total starts to trade with Iran, the United States won't trade with that company. Is that going to be an effective tool for the United States, and will it hurt our economy?
Okay. Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks, everybody. So, again, let's go through Phyllis, Tyler, and Lara, and then we'll just wrap up with a few action items that are already underway.
Okay, just quickly, I'll answer Art's point about the ground war in Yemen as well as the bombing in Yemen. It's the whole situation in Yemen is a complete disaster. It's rather complex. I think that the decision by the U.S. To back the Saudis in Yemen has a lot to do with Iran. I don't think it's a specific quid pro quo around this agreement. I think there's a broader question of what it would take for the U.S. to prove to the Sunni monarchies, these absolute petro monarchies in the region, that they are continuing to support them despite a move that is slightly towards rapprochement with Iran. We should be clear that right now, everyone, including President Obama and everybody else supporting the deal, is being very careful to say this is not a step towards a grand bargain. This is not a step towards a real rapprochement. We're going to have to fight for that once this deal goes through. We should be clear about that. Nobody is saying that this is what's underway. Objectively, it's there, but it's being denied. So this is going to be a very hard fight, but it remains for at once this agreement has been won and it's moving forward. And then on Kathleen's point about the impact of sanctions, one of the powerful arguments to use, I think, particularly for members of Congress who have any history of interest in foreign affairs in general, which is less than half of them, that this is going to seriously, that opposition to this deal will seriously undermine U.S. standing as a diplomatic leader in the world. It will also undermine U.S. sanctions. Now, to me, that's a good thing. U.S. sanctions have been a disaster for Iranian people. But for those who don't care about Iranian people and who might respond to a very pragmatic argument, because remember, Congress is not our turf. It's always about lesser evils. So being very tactical, I think, is the way to go here. Doesn't mean lying about something you don't believe, but you can certainly leave out things that you're concerned about and tell them the part of it, the part of the facts that they are concerned about, including, for example, the U.S. effort to maintain sanctions will be seriously undermined if the U.S. defaults on this agreement, because the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese are not about to follow the U.S. Congress and abandon this deal. They will try and go ahead with the deal, and they will continue to lift sanctions and trade with Iran, which will leave the United States thoroughly isolated. Now, many of us will have a different view of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in the overall scheme of things, but we're talking here to Congress. We're not talking to educate the American people. We're talking to Congress in 24 days about one vote. So we have to keep the focus very, very sharp.
Thanks, Phyllis. Tyler?
Yeah, just one brief comment. I mean, I don't think we should underestimate the need that people like Senator Blumenthal, other undecided Democrats in the Senate and the House feel over needing to hear the voices of those who support this deal. These are offices that are being bombarded with calls from opponents of the deal from 9 to 5. And these are people who want to support the president, want to support their Democratic president in this endeavor, and need to hear from voices in favor of this deal to do so. And they will take meetings. You will have access, unlike you had before. But those efforts need to be undertaken, and they need to be undertaken right now.
Okay, thank you, Tyler. And Lara? Are you still with us, Lara? Okay, maybe not.
Sorry, I was muted.
Oh, okay.
I was following your directions.
You were modeling good behavior. Thank you.
Yes, yes. I want to associate myself with that last point that Tyler made. I think that many activists who are engaging Congress right now are finding they have better access than perhaps they've ever had before, because members really do. They don't just need to hear from you. A lot of them want to hear from you. This is why it's so important to show up at the town hall. Again, I want to just make a pitch for a website, not mine, which is the 60 Days to Stop a War. That's what it's called, 60daystostopawar.com. Really good resource so you can be out in your communities voting with your feet. On Michael's point, the labor leader's statement, this is one of those things I cannot express enough enthusiasm for what you're doing there. You know, the United Steelworkers came out, I believe, a week ago with a statement of support for the deal. That got tremendous bounce. That got picked up in the press. It got tweeted out. We all saw it all over the place. Again, we're all looking for these sort of validators that will tell members of Congress at a very sort of gut level, this is where your supporters are. This is the heartland of your support. It's not just that there's military people saying it. It's not just that I can give you Israeli validators. The heartland of your constituents supports this. And whether that's the labor movement or the steel workers or the teachers, whatever ability all of you as activists and organizers have to organize the sort of messages that will get press, that will get media. I don't know if any of you saw, but already getting a lot of bounce right now is a letter that just came out of Jewish senior people in Hollywood. I think there were like 50 or 60 of them. Major names came out in support of the deal. Any one of them? That's nice. 60 of them signing on to a letter or an ad? That's news. And that's news that members of Congress will pay attention to. So, yay, Michael. Excellent. Any of you who have that ability to organize amongst specific sort of subsets of progressive constituencies, this is the time to be doing that too.
Thank you, Lara. And let me just add one more statement that you may not be aware of. In June, the United States Conference of Mayors, which is the nonpartisan national association of cities with populations over 30,000, unanimously adopted a resolution calling for U.S. leadership in nuclear disarmament and explicitly calling for support for the Iran deal. And that's something that you could take with you to your meetings. And we'll make sure that that's posted on the UFPJ Iran resource page. So,
Rusty, to the extent that it's possible, if that can be re-upped with a new date that is post-July 14th, the day the actual deal was signed, it is very different for people to come out in favor of a deal that's hypothetical and to come out in favor of a deal that's real. One is a much more substantial endorsement, because you're endorsing something that has teeth, that's real. So if anybody has the ability to look at something like that and say, hey, guys, we need to reissue that letter with a new date, that would be newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That can't be done, but I'll see what else could be done. I want to thank... I was about to ask you to... But I just want to thank our presenters and everyone who joined us, and invite Rusty to summarize action items.
Well, first, I really want to thank our presenters, who've just done a tremendous job in like 4 seconds, so that's really great. And remind everybody also that it is the middle of the summer, and probably we're all on vacation or wishing we were, and having, you know, so many people on this call, I think, is, you know, really says a lot about the energy that's really out there. I want to make one, like, very tiny point, and then sort of sum up. A tiny point is that some of us have gotten in the habit of, we have certain liberal Congress people, they're always on the right side, they always lose, so it's always easy to forget about them because, you know, oh, right, they're always on the right side. This isn't one of those cases, because the pressure that's coming from AIPAC and the related organizations is enormous. I'm in Brooklyn right now. None of our liberal Congress people have come out in favor of this deal. They may, but, I mean, it tells you something that that's not happening. So don't take anybody for granted unless you see that they have explicitly said they're supporting this deal. Assume that they need to get pressure. The other thing I just sort of want to summarize is I want to support, you know, what Laura said about this 60 days to stop a war. That's a really valuable resource right now because it's letting you know where your congressperson is actually appearing. Finally, one last thing. Nobody should let the excellent be the enemy of the good. Whatever folks can do, it's summer, it's a hard time to mobilize. Think about your group, think about yourself. What can you manage? Now, maybe it's only a phone call, maybe it's organizing a phone tree, maybe it's doing a petition, maybe it's doing postcards, going to a congressional meeting, writing a letter. You know, whatever it is that folks on this call can do, either as individuals or in groups, is all right now very, very necessary and very valuable. Finally, I just want to mention that there is a day of action that is planned for August 26th, and that'll be a day where there's going to be an effort. MoveOn is taking a big lead in this, of having actions at congressional districts all around the country. So you want to watch out for that. Again, 60 Days to Stop a War is a helpful resource. We will be posting things on the UFPJ website as well as resources. As Laura said, a lot of national organizations are working together on this. So, you know, we don't claim any special thing. You know, call, you know, whatever group you want to turn to nationally for more resources, that's all great. So, again, I want to just wrap up and thank everybody for taking the time to be on this call and for our speakers for doing a really great job.
And thanks you, Rusty. And I just want to remind folks that you will be able to listen to a recording of this call, and we will be getting the playback number to you by email and via the UFPJ website. So thank you, everybody. Till the next.
Thank you all.